You're listening to the WFYI Weekly News Podcast for the week of Monday, November 30th through Friday, December 4th. I'm Christopher Ayers. This week, we answer the question, why did some Marion County municipalities remain independent after the formation of UNIGOV?
You go to the grocery store. You see the people that are, you know, the people that are leading your community.
A performance from Sarah Grain and the Billions of Stars in our most recent WFYI small studio session.
I'm considering vinyl. People have been talking to me about cassette tape.
And a new makerspace encourages aspiring educators to consider innovative teaching ideas. Those stories and more are coming up. Please stay tuned. First this week, the Environmental Protection Agency recently released requirements for the amount of ethanol that must be blended into the nation's gasoline through the year 2016. As Indiana Public Broadcasting's Sarah Fenton reports, Indiana's role as an ethanol-producing giant means the state is paying attention.
The amounts are bigger than the ones the EPA proposed last spring. 2016's 18-billion-gallon requirement is about 4% higher than expected. How much each refinery needs to contribute to the Renewable Fuel Standard, or RFS, is dictated by their market share. Even though the law doesn't explicitly specify what sort of biofuel is required for the majority of the fuel, most ethanol is made from corn. And as Ken Parent, director of biofuels for the Indiana Corn Marketing Council, says, the greater the requirements, the happier the state's corn producers are.
It's played a critical role in making corn a profitable commodity for Indiana farmers to grow.
According to Parent, a little less than half of the state's corn goes directly to the state's 14 ethanol plants. But Purdue economist Wally Tyner says the increased demand for corn, thanks to the RFS, will mean higher prices for everything from beef to gas. He says the current low gas prices and higher ethanol prices will mean prices will go up at the pump, but only by a few cents.
Requiring that it be blended means that price, that cost, will be passed on to consumers.
RFS proponents say the amount is less than Congress originally envisioned back in 2007. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Sarah Fentiman, West Lafayette.
Teaching involves a lot of creativity because kids learn in different ways, no matter the subject. Take reading, for example. We read to kids, they sing the alphabet, and they trace letters in the air. All different approaches that help children learn to read and write. State Impact Indiana's Claire McInerney recently visited a new space at Indiana University School of Education in Bloomington, designed to help aspiring teachers consider fresh approaches to teaching.
I think it's like a laser, and it's like goes around cutting. And you can make cool designs, like that skeleton face.
7-year-old Aiden Lindsay cut the skeleton face with a laser cutter earlier. But right now, the machine is whizzing as it works to etch the logo of Aiden's favorite video game onto a piece of wood.
How does it know what to cut?
I think it knows it from the computer.
The laser cutter is one of many tools in the IU School of Education's new Makerspace, a room dedicated to helping teachers discover creative ways to teach tough concepts.
It's really unique.
Kylie Pepler is an associate professor in the school and exclusively studies how making stuff helps kids learn. She convinced the school of ed to fund the new makerspace and also devoted some grants from the National Science Foundation to get it up and running. Traditionally, makerspaces are used for science and technology innovation, which is why Pepler says this makerspace is rare.
Our faculty here are using making to kind of reinvent what it means for literacy studies, what it means for art education, what it means for every discipline.
In this space, graduate students and faculty members use students to test the techniques they've created. The projects represent many subject areas. For example, Adam Maltese wants to find a group of middle and high school students
to build what we're calling an e-birdhouse,
okay.
Which is essentially a birdhouse, but it's wired with sensors for all sorts of things to collect data on birds and their environment.
Students will design and construct the birdhouse, giving them science and technology skills. But Maltese says they'll also learn a lot about biology as they study birds living in the house. In the middle of the makerspace, as she sews a row of sequins onto a piece of fabric, graduate student Sophia Bender explains how teachers can use sewing to help their students learn geometry.
It's all about spatial reasoning. you start out with this two-dimensional fabric, and you have to think about how it's going to turn into a three-dimensional garment to fit someone. How do you take something flat and make it round?
If new teachers get to experiment with alternative techniques, Bender says they'll be better equipped to adapt to students' different learning styles. And when they see a sewing machine sitting in a home ec classroom, they'll be more likely to ask to borrow it to explain something such as spatial reasoning to their geometry class. Across the room, Sean Duncan is fiddling with board game pieces created by the 3D printer. His project aims to push students to be creative and work on a team using board games.
So we view this as really games as an artistic practice more than games as a thing that we want to have them make for educational purposes.
Duncan will host a game jam next semester for area kids, where they will come to the makerspace for 24 hours and create a board game from scratch. They will collaborate as a group, come up with a creative concept for the game, and create the physical parts needed to play. All of these projects establish a really important principle of making to learn. If you give kids a project they have ownership of, they'll work harder to learn the skills needed to complete it. For example, if a student is struggling with geometry, Bender says they might not care if they get a few problems wrong on their homework.
But if you calculate something wrong on a project you're making and it turns out not the way you want, you are motivated to try again.
Which is how she says we learn in the real world. When we encounter a problem, we research possible solutions and then try those methods to see what works. For State Impact Indiana, I'm Claire McInerney.
As part of a new series we're calling Curious Indy, we've been asking listeners what questions they have about the city of Indianapolis. Our first question was, why did Speedway, Lawrence, Beech Grove, and Southport remain independent municipalities after Marion County and the city of Indianapolis formed a unified city-county government, commonly known as Unigov? Well, 90.1 WFYI's Darren Mullen has the answer.
A few times each year, Dave and Jan Oath see their small-town Speedway neighborhood flooded with racing fans.
We enjoy the crowds for the two races. I mean,
we love that.
Dave has called Speedway home for all 75 years of his life. His father served the town as clerk treasurer in the 60s and 70s, the same time Indianapolis and Marion County combined their governments into Unigov.
I'm sure that he and the town board were very much against joining, that they definitely wanted to keep us as a separate town.
Many Marion County communities merged with Indianapolis, sacrificing local control for a more centralized city-county government. But towns of more than 5,000 people didn't have to join. And Speedway, Lawrence, Southport, and Beech Grove all said no thanks. One big reason, says Mark Fisher of the Indianapolis Chamber of Commerce, was money.
These communities were well-established. They had major employment centers. They were close enough to the city where they could benefit from the goings-on, but were far enough out, they wanted to maintain a sense of disconnection or autonomy.
They didn't need Unigov. Beech Grove had the rail yard. Lawrence had Fort Benjamin Harrison. Southport wanted its autonomy and hurried to incorporate just before the law took effect in 1970. And Speedway had Allison Transmission and the world-famous oval track. According to Speedway Chamber of Commerce Director Connie Harris, those assets have kept Speedway's tax rate lower than Indianapolis's.
We're very fortunate because we've got large corporations in our small community that keeps our tax base really low.
Speedway is a community in transition. Its historic Main Street, lined with mom-and-pop shops and restaurants, is being revitalized as more businesses flock to the area. But residents like Harris still want Speedway to have that small-town feel in the shadow of Indianapolis's skyscrapers.
You go to the grocery store, you see the people that are, you know the people that are leading your community. They're the same people that are teaching Sunday school, coaching your kids in soccer. To me, that's a good thing.
But will Speedway and the other communities ever join Indianapolis? Fisher says no, provided residents continue to support local control.
As long as their residents are happy with the service levels to tax rate levels, I think that they'll be able to continue to operate as standalone communities.
Harris remains adamant that Speedway will retain its autonomy.
We have our budget issues as well as anybody else, but at least we are making the decisions that affect ourselves. We have control.
As for the Oates, they want to remain in the independent town that their family has called home for three generations. Jan says many residents feel the same.
It's lovely. It's lovely. There are several families that are four generations and they all still live here. They did not want to move because of the small town that they live in. They're proud of this town.
For 90.1 WFYI News, I'm Darren Mullen.
To learn more about the Curious Indy Project, go to WFYI.org/Curious Indy and maybe even submit a question of your own to be featured in future Curious Indy stories.
Because of curiosity, all the vandals had to see the golden throne of ancient Rome and brought the city to its knees. Because of curiosity.
Finally, this week, an Indianapolis-based band says no to playing cover songs and maybe to releasing original music on cassette tape. 90.1's Jill Dittmeyer spoke with our newest small studio session band, Sarah Grain and the Billions of Stars.
Sarah Grain and the Billions of Stars first caught our ear with a tune called Dear Nostalgia when they entered our Tiny Desk Concert Contest earlier this year.
We were young, that was all. We were disoriented by a fall. We got up, brushed it off, and with backs to each other, we walked.
I woke up that morning and I got this text message from a friend saying, congratulations, with a link to the article where we were featured by WFYI.
And from there to our small studio session. Creating original music is what it's all about for Sarah and her bandmates Doug Sauter, Nate Gray, Mina Cohane, and Ryan Cook.
I want a quiet little room, a sunny little window where I can just stare, but I guess this field will do, meadow blue.
A song does not advance for me. It does not get to completion unless I become obsessed with it. Unless it gets in my head, unless I can't get it out, it kind of haunts me and kind of stalks me away.
Music into fans' hands any way that they can.
I definitely listen to CDs, but a lot of people that I know don't, so I'm considering vinyl. People have been talking to me about cassette tape. I'm like, could we bring this out on cassette tape?
That's a new thing, man. You know, vinyl and cassette, so, like it's kind of a nostalgic thing. People want to kind of rediscover that again.
Yeah.
So. Everybody has their phones, and you can't put a CD in a phone anymore, you know? It's like,
you can try.
It's going to work very well.
I'm looking forward to having physical copies because we do. Every time we play, people are asking. They want the music right then and there. And you might have their attention at that moment. And even though it's online and it's simple for them to go there, as soon as they are taken by, you know, the next demand, you've lost them. So you really do have to have it right then.
Sarah sees a bright future for the Indianapolis original music scene.
I see the tides turning because it's not just musicians and artists working in a vacuum. That doesn't work to make a musically and culturally rich city. It has to be partnerships with NPR and WFYI. It has to be partnerships with venues. It has to be partnerships with festivals and businesses. And just having music being a part of every single event that we do.
For 90.1 WFYI News, I'm Jill Dittmeyer.
Transition.
You can see the band's performance on our website. Just go to WFYI.org/small studio. That's it for this edition of the WFYI Weekly News Podcast. You can follow us online at WFYI.org, on Twitter at WFYI News, and on Facebook, WFYI. You can subscribe to this podcast on iTunes or Stitcher. You can stream it on the web at SoundCloud. Just search WFYI. This has been a production of WFYI News, produced at 90.1 WFYI Public Radio Studios in Indianapolis. I'm Christopher Ayers. Thanks for listening.